This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, April 14, 2008. From Pacifica Station, KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. One of the U.S. Army's leading voices of dissent is promoted, which may illustrate the pervasive nature of opposition in the ranks. Utah residents want a say in a proposed water pipeline that critics claim will only add to urban sprawl. And we'll check in on the campaign trail with the Pennsylvania primaries just around the corner. All that and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. The Prime Minister of Haiti has been forced to step down as a result of last week's food riots. The skyrocketing price of staple foods sparked demonstrations and unrest throughout the Caribbean nation. Haiti is the poorest country in the hemisphere, and the overwhelming majority of its citizens live on less than $2 a day. Soaring food prices have put even basic nutrition out of reach for many Haitians. President René Préval has announced subsidies to reduce the price consumers pay for rice, as well as measures aimed at increasing production in the countryside. In the U.S., the United Auto Workers Union today rejected the latest offer from American Axle. Doug Cunningham spoke with workers on the American Axle picket line in Detroit.
Despite being on strike for 6 weeks, workers standing here in the cold in Detroit outside the big American Axle plant are still in no mood to cut their wages in half and give up benefits to the profitable company. Striker Chris Workman says this is easy for all workers, union or not, to understand.
This is a fight for our livelihoods here, and not only the UAWs, but throughout the rest of the country. Whatever happens here is going to have a domino effect throughout the other auto parts manufacturers. It's very important that we make a stand here. And stop breaking down the middle class, because that's what they're doing. We're not greedy people. We just want to maintain a living along with the rest of the world. And we want you, the rest of the world, to support us.
A striker who identified himself as D says American Axle is financially attacking workers.
It's an attack against the working class, and they need to make a certain type of money per year. So they have to come to us for it. But when we go to them for raises, it's more, no, we'll see what we can do.
American Axle is a major parts supplier to GM and other automakers. Its demand to cut wages in half and end pensions and health care benefits for future retirees triggered the UAW strike, which in turn has shut down production at dozens of GM plants nationwide. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Doug Cunningham.
An investigation by the Fort Myers News Press reveals that people with ties or possible ties to Burger King have attempted to infiltrate the Student Farm Worker Alliance and the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. Both groups campaign to pressure fast food giants to use their buying power to raise wages and put an end to modern-day slavery in Florida's tomato fields. And Alusia Knoll has more.
Members of the Student Farm Worker Alliance and the Coalition of Immokalee Workers have been pressuring Burger King for the past year to pay one penny more per pound for the tomatoes they purchase from Florida growers. Burger King has refused, although giants like McDonald's and Taco Bell have both agreed to the largely immigrant farm workers' demands after similar campaigns. According to Student Farm Worker Alliance organizer Mark Rodriguez, Burger King has hired people to infiltrate their organization.
A woman by the name of Kara Schaefer called our office posing as a student and trying to get on our conference calls. And it turned out later on that she's actually the president of a private investigation / intelligence firm based right outside of Miami, which is where Burger King has its headquarters, ironically enough.
On their website, this firm, Diplomatic Tactical Services, says they specialize in, quote, handling all types of investigative activity during strikes and organizational attempts. Burger King spokesman Kiva Silversmith says he's unaware of any efforts by his company to spy on the farmworker organizations. The Student Farmworker Alliance and Coalition of Immokalee Workers say that they will continue their work undeterred, confident that Burger King will eventually agree to pay one penny more per pound of Florida tomatoes. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Andalusia Knoll.
Zimbabwe's High Court has rejected an argument from the country's leading opposition party to immediately release the results of the presidential election. Official results are still unknown, more than 2 weeks after Zimbabweans cast their votes in an election that pitted an opposition leader against the long-ruling president, Robert Mugabe. Maoists in India appeared to have won a landslide victory in last week's elections. Nepal's Maoist agreed to transition from a guerrilla force to a political party just 2 years ago. Although the results are not yet official, preliminary tallies leave little doubt that the Maoists will hold the majority of elected seats in a constituent assembly to rewrite Nepal's constitution. One country paying close attention to the Nepali election is neighboring India, which has been battling its own Maoist insurgency for decades. Maoist militants in the Indian state of Bihar launched a deadly attack on a police station last night. India's prime minister recently described the Maoist as the gravest threat to internal security. Those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
The Pennsylvania primary is almost here, just 8 days away. Hillary Clinton is trying to gain any leverage she can. It's largely been jumping on Barack Obama for comments he made that people who cling to guns or religion are bitter. Meanwhile, presumptive Republican nominee John McCain said he would not leave Iraq if it meant looking for Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Speaking to a group of journalists at the Associated Press's annual convention in Washington, D.C., Senator John McCain said he would not focus on Osama bin Laden if it meant moving resources from Iraq.
I would not do that unless General Petraeus said that he felt that the situation called for that. I understand how tough things are. I understand the stress on the military.
It's unlikely that General Petraeus would ever recommend shifting attention to Osama bin Laden, since Petraeus is in command of Iraq, unless bin Laden planted himself there. Petraeus's boss, the CENTCOM commander or the defense secretary, at the behest of the president, would likely make such recommendations. McCain also condemned reporting that unveiled the president's warrantless surveillance program.
And I understand completely why the government, charged with defending our security, would want to discourage that from happening and hold the people who disclose that damaging information accountable for their action.
Hillary Clinton has spent the past couple of days highlighting Barack Obama's comments about bitter people who cling to guns and religion. She's calling him an elitist and out of touch with voters, hoping that message resonates with the working class voters who head to the polls next Tuesday in Pennsylvania.
I do not believe, as Senator Obama apparently does, that Americans in small towns and small cities and rural areas cling to religion or gun ownership out of frustration.
Obama's words have received far more scrutiny than false statements made by Bill Clinton for saying Hillary told false stories about landing in Bosnia under sniper fire because she was tired at late-night campaign stops. Senator Clinton made such comments often at morning campaign rallies. Meanwhile, Obama has been trying to recoup from his possibly damaging comments. Here he is at a candidates' forum on manufacturing in Pennsylvania.
When I hear my opponents, both of whom spent decades in Washington, saying I'm out of touch, it's time to cut through the rhetoric and look at the reality.
All three candidates will spend their time through tax day talking about the economy. Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama told the manufacturers that they will fix NAFTA. And both the Republican and Democratic parties will use tax day to highlight differences in policies. Democrats will paint McCain as an enabler of the rich who will extend Bush's tax cuts. The Republicans will paint the Democratic candidates as big spending, tax-hiking liberals. Bob McIntyre, director of Citizens for Tax Justice, sums up the candidates' positions on taxes and funding priorities.
Democrats have each talked about funding something that will insure everybody for health expenses. And they've talked about, you know, dealing with the crumbling infrastructure. They've talked about a lot of things, but they haven't really pulled the trigger on how they're going to pay for all these things, because right now their programs don't add up.
McIntyre on McCain's plan.
He wants tax cuts. He wants to continue the war in Iraq. And his only way to pay for that he suggested in any serious way, is to cut way back on Social Security benefits. I think that's not going to happen, which is a good thing. But that means he has nothing to pay for this enormous amount of deficit spending that we'd face if he became president.
The candidates' funding and tax priorities must first pass through Congress, of course. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Democrats in Washington recently stalled a free trade agreement with Colombia, asking the White House to provide more protection to U.S. workers who would lose their jobs if the deal is signed. The Colombian government was disappointed by the decision, saying it would push back the country's development. But Colombian President Álvaro Uribe's opposition is relieved. They say that the FTA would put millions of small farmers out of business, encouraging them to grow illegal crops like coca leaf to make a living. Manuel Rueda visited the Cauca Valley, one of Colombia's main centers for cocaine production.
The Cauca Valley is one of Colombia's most fertile regions, but most of the land here is taken up by large sugarcane estates, owned by some of the country's richest families. In the surrounding mountains, indigenous people and small farmers tend to their modest plots. They have traditionally made a living from growing coffee, corn, and beans. But many are also growing marijuana and coca, the plant that's used to make cocaine. Herman Valencia used to manage a small marijuana plantation, but he's now a human rights observer for the local indigenous association. He says that farmers are growing coca out of economic necessity, but he's trying to convince them to abandon the coca leaf in order to keep the area clear of armed groups.
The guerrillas promote and commercialize the coca crop, and for every amount that is produced, they charge a tax. That's why here, insurgents will be around the illegal crops. Then the army comes in under the pretext that they are coming to eradicate the illegal crops. Confrontations happen, and civilians pay the price.
But free trade could complicate Valencia's job. Senator Jorge Robledo has written extensively on the impacts of the agreement. He says that cheap imports of wheat, corn, and other grains are putting small farmers out of business, forcing them to grow coca to make ends meet.
The peasant who grows coca is not a drug trafficker, he is simply a farmer. So if the only farming activity that produces benefits is coca, then they will grow coca. They constantly tell the national government to give them another option to grow something else, but there are no options. Well, then they grow coca.
Deme una opción agrícola y yo siembro otra cosa.
Robledo points out that Colombia now imports almost 10 times more food than it did in the early 90s. But the Colombian government does offer some protection to small farmers, especially those who live in conflict zones like the Cauca Valley, where the guerrillas promote the coca crop. Israel Escue lives in La Selva, a former cattle ranch that was occupied by a dozen families in the early 90s.
Before the project began 4 years ago, we were growing corn and beans and some yuca, but we were doing it in a very traditional way. We weren't using technology like we are now, utilizing our resources.
Esque's small farm now mixes cash crops like cocoa with basic foods like corn, poultry, and even fish. The project is called Valle en Paz, or Peace Valley. It provides him with technical support and credit to develop new crops. And it has helped Esque and his neighbors to form a cooperative to which they sell their goods to large supermarkets. The government says that projects like this one will make farmers more competitive, dissuading them from growing the coca leaf. And development agencies like USAID are funding many projects like La Selva all around the country. But the indigenous authorities in the Cauca Valley oppose such schemes. Manuel Rosenthal has worked with the NASA people for over 20 years.
What is really happening is a social program that can be equated to a sort of a charity. You get the poor, you give them a little bit of money, and you help them produce at poverty and subsistence levels so that they can survive for now.
Indigenous leaders say that projects like Valle en Paz will force small farmers to rely on a few buyers from large supermarkets. And they fear that in the long run, multinational corporations will dictate what's grown on their lands and at what price. The solution to the coca problem, they say, is for the government to redistribute the land, so that a greater number of small farmers can descend from the mountains to grow fruits and cereals on the valley's fertile floor. But the government is currently backing the production of biofuels, and this industry feeds off the sugarcane estates that currently cover much of the Cauca Valley. I'm Manuel Rueda for FSRN in the Cauca Valley, Colombia.
The Israeli military issued orders in late February for the closure and confiscation of orphanages, schools, and other facilities in the West Bank city of Hebron, owned by the Islamic Charitable Society, accusing the group of having ties with Hamas. The organization has filed an appeal with Israel's High Court, which demanded the military provide justification by April 6. The military asked for an extension but has yet to provide evidence, and the Israeli court has not yet ruled on the appeal. The closure orders were temporarily frozen for a week, but the Israeli army told the charity last week that they had until Sunday to evacuate. FSRN's Zach Badarf reports that as of today, there has been no move to force the closure.
The military order asserts the 46-year-old charity is connected to the militant organization Hamas and says the buildings must be closed to maintain what it terms security of the area and general order. The Israeli military claims the foundation's resources are devoted to funding Hamas. The Islamic Charitable Society is also accused of training youths in jihad principles and spreading Hamas principles. The charity denies the accusations. At a press conference inside the girls' orphanage, Abd al-Karim Farah, the charity's legal representative, says he has no doubt his organization would win in court if the Israeli legal system was just.
The allegations being leveled against us are totally and completely and absolutely baseless. They are unfounded. We challenge the Israeli government and the Israeli army to produce a single piece of tangible evidence to corroborate their concocted allegations. So far, they haven't done that.
Rashid Rashid, an English teacher at the charity's boys' school, says he has not seen any action by Hamas at the schools in the 12 years he's worked there. But he admits about 20 to 25 of the total 550 employees working for the organization do have ties with the Hamas political party. But he claims the organization has no formal connection with the militant group.
I am not Hamas. I am not Fatah. I smoke. I am not a fanatic. I am a normal person. I have no hatred for Israel or for anybody else. I'm just a teacher. I have never been told to tell my students to hate Israelis or Jews or to kill or to teach them violence. Never ever.
The society's program serves 7,000 children, including 300 who live in two orphanages. Mohammed Jamal Sahad, deputy head of the Islamic Student Association, is worried about the orphan's psychological well-being. He said the Israeli troops have, in his words, terrorized them with the fear that they'll be out on the streets. Further, he said academic performance of the students has been undermined in the past month. The school is hiring psychological specialists to come help the youngsters.
Right now, there is overwhelming tension and stress among the kids. And frankly, we don't know what to do. The harm to the children cannot be underestimated.
Speaking on behalf of the orphans, Annabelle Shota said she and her classmates are worried they'll be made homeless because of Israel's decision.
Who will put the happiness in our hearts in the days of Eid? Or who will protect us from being lost? Or who will be our shelter in the days of winter? We hope that the echo of our voice will reach your heart to show you our grief and misery as a result of this oppressive verdict.
According to the military order, anyone entering or using the buildings may be imprisoned for 5 years and have his property confiscated or demolished. International peace activists have joined the orphans at the orphanage in defiance of the order by spending their days and nights in the schools to document and report the actions of the Israeli military in the event the order is carried out. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Zach Badarwolf reporting from Hebron in the West Bank.
Some 150 southwestern Utah residents gathered for a water symposium Saturday, calling for a referendum on a proposed water pipeline for a growing area that they say will endanger water resources and contribute to urban sprawl. John Pike has more.
The St. George, Utah area on Interstate 15 between Salt Lake City and Las Vegas has grown by almost half since the 2000 census to about 150,000. The latest proposal for water to feed this growing population is to run a pipeline from Lake Powell on the Utah-Arizona border to St. George. A report in the journal Science last year predicted a 100-year drought for the American Southwest that would only be exacerbated by increasing population. That study identified the Colorado River as a lifeline for the region during this drought. Some residents of the area, however, feel that the project is too expensive. It could run $1 billion, hasn't had enough public input, and could contribute to urban sprawl and an unsustainable population. The Colorado River feeds Lake Powell, an artificial body of water. It was created by the federal government in the 1950s as part of a larger project to dam up the Colorado to produce electricity. The Washington County Water Conservancy District wants to draw water for the St. George area from this popular vacation and recreation spot. Corey Cram, a spokesperson for the pipeline project, says the Lake Powell pipeline is the cheapest alternative on the table, and the water is plentiful.
The Colorado River at Lake Powell is also a very reliable water supply. You look at the storage projects on the Colorado River system, and they're working like they're supposed to. And right now, the Lake Powell is about half full. And that's what's expected when you're in the middle of an 8-year drought.
Cram also says that the district does a good job of conserving water in the area. Cram says the project is needed to support the expected population of the area. What may help the growing demand for water in the area is that there are limits to growth in this area. Cram says that much of the area is owned by public entities, and that will help stem the tide of growth. Paul Van Dam is a former Utah Attorney General and a property owner in both Salt Lake and in the St. George area. Van Dam says that bringing more water into the area from Lake Powell will only further the problem.
The Colorado River is going to slow down somewhat. And there seems to be a distinct possibility that within 20 to 30 years, there is not going to be sufficient water by any means to continue to supply the number of people on the Colorado River who are now dependent upon it.
Van Dam says that he and other concerned citizens are also concerned about what they say is a lack of public input for a major public project. Van Dam says that if they have to, they'll use the legal system to dam up the process. John Pike, Free Speech Radio News.
One of the leading voices of dissent inside the U.S. Army has been promoted. Sergeant Ron Cantu, who signed a petition to Congress demanding the U.S. withdraw from Iraq and gave interviews to 60 Minutes, Democracy Now!, and Free Speech Radio News detailing his opposition to the war, has seen his rank upgraded to staff sergeant. Some observers say Cantu's promotion shows the military is now so stressed by the ongoing war that it's finding it difficult to crack down on dissent within the ranks. Aaron Glantz has more.
Few members of the armed forces have made their disgust with the war in Iraq more public than Ron Cantu. The 30-year-old Los Angeles native began speaking out during his second tour in Iraq, launching an online forum for anti-war GIs at soldiersvoices.net, signing petitions against the war and giving interviews to major U.S. media outlets while still stationed in Baghdad. Now as a staff sergeant, Cantu says he'll teach the soldiers under him to follow the Geneva Convention and other laws of war.
There's a lot of soldiers out there who wouldn't recognize an unlawful order if it bit them on the behind, so I'm going to make sure that they're very familiar with the laws of armed conflict. I just want to make sure that they do what they can to keep their ethics and their moral standard and to stay out of trouble should anything happen.
Cantu hopes the soldiers under his command will behave differently than he did during his first tour in Iraq.
We had a policy of, quote-unquote, making a statement. If we got blown up, we would just react violently. If a bomb went off on our convoy, all of the guns would open up and pretty much just mass punishment the area that we were in. Windows, cars on the side of the road, animals, sheep. I saw sheep. It was a revenge setting.
Most service members who speak out are not given the same treatment Ron Cantu got. Former Marine Corps Sergeant Liam Madden also signed the petition against the war and began holding workshops about the politics of the war on his base at Quantico, Virginia, before bringing down the wrath of his chain of command.
Basically, they just gave me a lousy job and they told all my peers that they were not allowed to talk to Sergeant Madden. It was a pretty lonely time. The platoon I was in, the non-commissioned officer in charge of that platoon said, "You Marines are no longer to talk to Sergeant Madden." All the peers that I had met and, you know, become acquainted with over the last year, they were basically shut off. And if any of them were to talk to me, like in the barracks or something off duty, they were very nervous about it.
Jeff Patterson is Project Director of Courage to Resist, which helps troops speak out against the war from within the military. He says the depleted state of the Army has military brass increasingly reluctant to expel soldiers who oppose the war, so people who work within the rules, like Sergeant Ron Cantu, are promoted.
I think there are certainly reasons for the military to overlook many issues today. In recruiting, they're overlooking whether you have a high school diploma, they're overlooking whether you have former criminal history. And once you're in the military, they're overlooking injuries, and now they're even overlooking people that are openly speaking out, apparently, against the Iraq war. So as long as you do your job, there's a basis for the military to say, well, thank you very much. We need your body in Iraq, regardless if we don't like what you're saying.
Cantu says his superiors told him he was being promoted because he served close to 10 years in the military and has met all training requirements. It's unclear whether Cantu slipped through the cracks or the Army purposefully overlooked his activist work.
It doesn't make much sense that, I think, honestly, in all God honesty, I think I just slipped through some bureaucratic cracks.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz.
And now, from his cell on Pennsylvania's death row, a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Symbols versus substance. Our national politics is largely the stuff of illusion. It is the stuff of spin. It is the manipulation of images to pluck the heartstrings or to stoke the furnaces of emotion. Any emotion will do. Love, hate, fear, all are but instruments upon which politicians will play to move people to the polls, to get them either to vote for them or against their opponents. What all of this really means in the real day-to-day lives of many of these voters is actually quite minimal, for politicians don't really care about what voters want. They care about those who can afford them, those who pay them well for their services. In essence, politics is a business, and voters are but bare necessities. We see this in the vast, obscene amounts of money raised for virtually all political offices. At bottom, politics is the elevation of symbol over substance, for it seeks to create the illusion of change, while leaving unchanged the essential power relations at the lower levels of society. Politics is great for changing forms, but it stumbles at changing essentials. We've seen that in South Africa, where the faces of those in political power have changed dramatically in its darkest sense from palest white to darkest black. And yet, those who hold financial power, immense wealth, and thus those who control politicians, remain predominantly white and remain in ultimate control. Here in the U.S., we often boast about blacks having more and more political offices in local, state, and federal governments. Yet, if this is so, and it is, why are our lives so miserable, so threatened, so endangered? Why are our communities so dysfunctional? Why are black schools so underperforming? Why are black and Latino homeowners the bulk of folks losing their homes to foreclosures? How is it that more black politicians ultimately means less black political power? It's because black-faced politicians can best advance the aims of white economic supremacy. For they are but employees of white wealth who do the duty of those who can afford them. Alexis de Tocqueville, the French foremost observer of American politics, noted, "Than politics, the American citizen knows no higher profession, for it is the most lucrative." Black politicians confuse us with their presence, not their power. For power is the ability to make change in the conditions of people's lives, to represent their interests, and to gain resources for the betterment of black people and their communities. Presence is merely being there in the place of a white politician, doing essentially nothing differently. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. You can send us your feedback. Just drop us an email to comments@fsrn.org. That's comments@fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Tina Giese. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young, and our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Antonio Ortiz and Rose Katapchi. From KPFK in L.A., I'm Aura Bogado.